Welcome to a new podcast from Pituitary World News. Today, we are talking with Dan Jeffries. Dan Jeffries has a very interesting story that he's dealing with two rare diseases. Dan is a patient, advocate, and an author, and wrote a book called Me, Myself, and I, spelled E-Y-E, which is a funny, sometimes very lighthearted view of his experiences. We will talk more about the book with Dan later. I first came aware of Dan from a news program that aired on the BBC America. It caught my attention because it referred to acromegaly. Dan is from Bristol, United Kingdom, and we recently participated together in a discussion at the Canadian National Acromegaly Support Group Conference, where we discussed doing a podcast at some point. So here we are. So welcome, Dan. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
No, my pleasure. I'm really, really glad to be involved. Thank you for asking.
Great. So why don't we start, we'll get right into it, and why don't we start by you telling us about your unique situation in that you're dealing with two rare diseases.
Okay. How long have we got?
Well,
that's right. I'm only joking. It's such a long story, but it's fine. So, yes, I was born with a very rare condition called Wyburn-Mason syndrome, which is a arteriovenous malformation, also known as a retinoencephalofacial angiomatosis, which I think is one of the longest medical phrases out there.
And it's amazing that you learned to do it.
I know, I've said it so many times. Basically, it's what it is a mass of enlarged blood vessels around the optic nerve and the midbrain. And one of the consequences is that I'm blind in my left eye. So from about the age of four, my dad, who's partially sighted himself, he took me to an optician's just as a matter of precaution. And the optician looked in my left eye and no doubt his jaw dropped when he saw these huge blood vessels. And I got referred to Bristol Eye Hospital, which is not too far from me. And then for the next few years, I underwent various tests. I had, looking back at my notes, it would appear I had some vision, but I really don't remember seeing anything out of it. And by the age of, I think, 10 or 11, it was pronounced that I was completely blind in that eye. I'm also short-sighted in my right eye as well, but I wear glasses and I don't have any issues with seeing distance or anything like that. But obviously, I have limited peripheral vision because I'm blind in my left eye. So this incredibly rare condition, I was told originally it's about 1 in 3 million people had it. But then I was later told that they think there's only been about 30 cases in the last 50 years worldwide. So that's incredibly rare. And I worked it out to be about 1 in 70 million people. Mm. Now, that's people who have been diagnosed with it. I'm sure there are more than that. But either way, it's an incredibly rare condition.
Yeah.
So that meant whenever I went to Bristol Eye Hospital, I had queues of specialists waiting up to come and have a look in my eye.
Yeah,
because the likelihood of them seeing it again would be incredibly remote.
Sure.
So I lived with that all through my teens and through university. And I moved back to Bristol after studying my degree. And I started to notice something wasn't quite right when I was working for the BBC, funnily enough, and I was a sort of exhibition host.
Yeah.
And I was stood standing around, and suddenly the vision in my right eye started to go very pixelated. And I had this kind of spike of vision in the middle of my eye, and everything around it was fuzzy and it really freaked me out. And obviously, when you've only got one eye, it's pretty nerve-wracking when happens to the other one. But I didn't really think anything about it, and it didn't really happen again. And then a few years later, I was probably 27, 28. I went to the dentist, and my dentist noticed that I had two lower right molars that were stopping me from biting down on the back of my jaw, on the back of my teeth. And it was making eating very difficult. So I got referred to the dental hospital and I had these two molars removed. And it was noticed that my jaw had kind of changed and I couldn't bite down on the back of my teeth, on the back of my jaw. But at no point did anyone think, I wonder why this is. I just got the two teeth removed and that was it. And then over the next couple of years, I was working. I had a girlfriend, but I didn't really have any energy. I had no real interest in sex and relationships. I was writing music, but didn't really want to further my career. I would see people that I hadn't seen for a long time who didn't recognize me because my face had changed to some extent and the shape of my head had changed. I had to get a ring cut off my finger because my hands had grown so big that I couldn't wear this ring anymore. But of course, I didn't think anything was wrong. I just thought I was growing old or changing or whatever it was.
Yes.
And then
that is so typical. No, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one of the big issues with our condition is that we just don't recognize it early on.
Exactly.
And by a stroke of luck, really, I got a letter from Bristol Eye Hospital. This was in 2007, start of 2007. And the letter said, we are doing some exams for final year ophthalmologists, and we would like you to come in because you've got such a rare eye condition that we want them to try and diagnose it as part of your exam, as part of their exam. And I thought, brilliant. I can help. And they were going to pay me £15. So I thought, fantastic, let's go. So I made my way there and I'm sat in the chair waiting for the first student to arrive. And when they do, the examiner says to the student, here's the patient, what do you see? And I'll never forget those words. It was because they were going to look at me as a whole, not just immediately look in my eyes.
Yeah, what a great education, no?
Exactly. So the student took a step back and looked at me and said, well, he's got very large hands and a protruding jaw and an exposed forehead, very pronounced facial features. And the examiner said, well, why do you think this might be? And they said, could be due to excessive release of growth hormones due to a pituitary adenoma. And I'm sat there thinking, no, you've got it wrong. It's Wyburn-Mason syndrome. It's not whatever you think it is.
It's funny, but it's not.
Yeah, exactly. But then the second person said it, and then the third person said it, and then the fourth person said it. And I'm sat there thinking, I mean, I didn't understand what it meant. It was technical language to me.
Yeah.
But once pretty much everyone had said it, I said to the examiner running the session, I said, I don't know what they're talking about, adenomas and pituitaries. And he said, well, you should go and see a doctor. You might have something called acromegaly. So I ran out of the hospital, typed acromegaly into Google, read the symptoms, and that was it. I knew at that very moment that I had a benign tumor in my pituitary gland because I read through all the symptoms of enlarged feet. Well, my feet had grown two sizes. My hands had grown. My face had changed. My testosterone levels had dropped. I looked different. All of the symptoms made sense. Yeah. It's not like I typed in those symptoms and it told me acromegaly.
Yeah.
I was given a name and that was really important.
Wow. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I immediately phoned my parents and said, I know what's wrong with me. And, of course, you can imagine how frightening it was for them, for me to have to tell them that I had a brain tumor.
Another condition, yeah.
Well, exactly, yeah. And we'd lived with the Wyburn-Mason all my life. It was dormant. Okay, I was blind in one eye, but...
You adapt, sure.
Yeah, we could cope with it. But now we had to undergo tests, and I immediately contacted a doctor, went to see my doctor the next day. He typed into Google what the procedure was to test for growth hormone levels, because doctors don't know. They're not expected to know every test of a rare condition. Yeah. So we did the IGF-1 test and the glucose tolerance test.
Yeah.
And it came back, you know, off the chart.
Yes.
And then I had to undergo various MRI scans. There was, of course, a lot of concern because if they were going to do transsphenoidal surgery, then they were going to have to go up through the nose, which we know is the regular process.
Yes.
But, of course, I had this massive AVM in the way. Wow. And that's what they needed to check out. So I underwent an angiogram. And that showed them, obviously, the sort of vascular pathways. But as soon as I came out of the angiogram, I started to get really bad chest pains.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, I was then diagnosed with a leaking heart valve. So I'm pretty sure that the acromegaly had played havoc with my internal organs and caused my heart valves to grow, and therefore this leaking heart valve was discovered.
Yeah. So how are you doing now? You sound terrific. I know the last time I saw you, you looked great. I know a little tired from the flight, but other than that.
Yeah, I'm really good. I mean, it's been 10 years since the surgery. This month, actually.
Yes.
So it's quite an important occasion for me. You know, it took a few years to recover. I'm not going to deny. You know, I was very lucky that they removed the whole of the tumor. I was very unlucky that I caught meningitis when I came back home, and I had to go back in for 2 weeks, which, you know, was horrible.
Yeah.
But once I came out of hospital and they had fixed the CSF leak, my body and my face started to turn back to how it was.
Yeah, or isn't at least, amazing how that happens?
It's incredible. Within days, if not weeks. I've got some photos that, you know, I put in the book of me sort of like undergoing this transitional period. And it's really bizarre to look at.
Yes. Yeah.
But it took me.
We've seen photographs of before and after that are remarkable. Yeah,
it really is.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say that the impact that the condition has on your own perception of how you look, I think, is one of the hardest things to deal with. You looked a certain way, and then suddenly this thing makes you, I'm going to say ugly in inverted commas, because it does. It can affect your smile quite badly. You know, it makes your features quite pronounced.
Yeah.
And we know that acromegalics have been caricatured through literature and films, you know. And now you have to deal not only with a lack of testosterone and other hormonal imbalances, but you also have to deal with the fact that you don't look the same as you once did.
Yeah.
And that took me a long time, really a good 8-9 years until I was kind of happy with how I looked again. So that was one of the sort of biggest implications of it.
Thankfully, I think that's one of the things we want to really dispel, is that, that, you know, caricature or perception that the disease has. Yeah, because it can, as we say, it can happen to everyone at any time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. But you know, like I said, 10 years on, I'm feeling pretty good. I've been told there is no, well, I'm in remission, so there is minimal tumor left, and they're pretty sure that it is unlikely to regrow. There's such a small amount, but of course.
We always know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I'm very positive. I feel generally pretty good. So yeah, for once, my health is sort of not a big issue, which is quite nice.
That's excellent to hear. So I know that you have been involved in raising awareness and advocacy. Trying to get the word out about this condition and using your considerable talents as a writer to do so. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your awareness efforts and what do you see as maybe our community's unmet needs? Sorry about that.
Okay.
Opportunities, you know, in the future to get more involved or raise awareness.
Sure. Well, I guess you're an advocate from the moment that you're diagnosed in a very strange way, because suddenly you become an expert on your condition, and your family does, and your friends start knowing about it. And of course, with the rise of social media, people are made aware very quickly that you have something wrong, and you're undergoing treatment for this very rare condition. I really got involved with the Pituitary Foundation, who are actually based in Bristol and just down the road from me, when I first wrote the book. So I was sort of going through the last few months of getting it ready, and I wanted not necessarily support but or acknowledgement, but I wanted the Pituitary Foundation to read it and just sort of be prepared to sort of promote it, really. Mm-hmm. And once the book was went live, I started to be asked to do talks and put together presentations. And I think it was earlier this year, I was asked to talk to Pfizer, for example, as part of Rare Disease Awareness Day.
Yeah.
You know, that was amazing, talking to 70, 80 people, most of them interested in rare disease. And that I got that gig, in for want of a better word, yes, off the back of the Pituitary Foundation.
You've spoken like a true musician.
Yeah, I know. I can't help it. The Pituitary Foundation asked me to be a represent the Pituitary Foundation on their behalf, to a volunteer ambassador. That's the proper phrase. Yeah. Talk on their behalf, you know, raise awareness of pituitary conditions. And so earlier this year, I decided to organize the first ever get together or meet up for acromegalics in the UK.
Okay.
I don't think it had really happened before. I think pituitary patients often got together, but not acromegalics. So I organized that in Birmingham with the help of the Pituitary Foundation, and we had over 40 nearly 50 people turn up, either with acromegaly, having maybe just been diagnosed. We had some people who were undergoing surgery a couple of weeks after the meeting. We had friends and family turn up as well. We had specialists from the hospital talk about what to expect in surgery, the recovery it was amazing. And we filmed it all. We did Facebook Live and streamed the videos live. And one stream that we did, where we had three patients tell their stories, had over 1,000 views.
Wow. Well, I would love to, if you send me that, we can definitely publish and put it on the, and if you have a recording of it, that would be
fantastic. Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, I've been proactive in doing it. I mean, I love organizing things and I like seeing people get together. Then kind of off the back of that, I was asked to apply for a bursary to attend the Vancouver acromegalics get together or conference.
Yeah, the National Canadian
Canada
support group. Yeah.
So I sent an email. I kind of outlined the work I had done, talks at Pfizer, videos for Novartis, the acromegaly day that we did. And I was very fortunate to win. So that's when I came over to Canada, all expenses paid, more or less, and met lots of people, managed to get a box of books shipped out as well, which I managed to sell.
Excellent.
Met fantastic people like yourself and other advocates and specialists that are working really hard in this field. And it was a fantastic few days, apart from the fact I had to go to hospital twice because of horrendous nosebleeds. But we'll gloss over that for the minute.
Yeah.
But it was brilliant. So, you know, I think everyone can be an advocate. You don't have to be organizing conferences. But you can share stories. You organize local meetings in your city or your sort of county or your area, just to try and get people together. Anything that you can do. I think it's Acromegaly Awareness Day on, is it November the 1st? I think it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, share anything you can. Just social media is such a huge platform that it's much, much easier to get information and good information out.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. And as you say, good information, because there's so much misinformation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think one of the things that I would really love to see is the Canadian, the American, the UK, the Australian. There's a lot of separate forums, and I would really love to see a kind of global acromegaly group or discussion board where people from all over the world can really share these ideas. We know that America is obviously the biggest country, one of the biggest countries, and probably has the most proactive or the most amount of users with acromegaly.
Yeah.
But I think we just need to try and share all of these good stories and this information, you know, around the world as much as we can, because sometimes we do end up on our own little pockets.
Yeah, I am. I'm totally agree with you. And I think one of the, you know, one of the challenges is languages, obviously, but we are working on that as we speak, trying to find somebody to fund the translation of the website, and working with the World Alliance of Pituitary Organizations, which is a new organization in the Netherlands.
Yeah,
And they're doing a nice job of starting this. So we've partnered with them to see if we can make it happen faster. Because I think you're absolutely correct, and hopefully we'll see you involved in that as well.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah,
one of the projects I want to try and do next year is I think it's really important that we have a platform for people to tell their story. Every acromegaly story is different, and this is the fascinating thing about this condition. Rarely is the diagnosis the same. Rarely is the outcome the same. You know, there are so many permutations. And so what I want to do is that, and there's software out there and there's websites out there, is to build for people, to encourage patients to build a timeline of their illness from the moment they were diagnosed, or even what they did before they were diagnosed, through the diagnosis and then afterwards. And that's something that they can then keep updated.
Yeah, and you know, that would be so helpful for not just other people, but educators.
Specialists,
Specialists exactly. And people that need to be aware of it, that unfortunately, as you mentioned very well, they're not. They're not aware. That's why these things take so long.
And I think that would be a fantastic resource. And it also would potentially break down the language barrier in that if you want to look for a story in French or Russian or Hindu or whatever it might be, people on there have the ability to tell their story in that way. That's my next project for next year.
That's a great number of things that you're doing for you know, the acromegaly community and really the awareness of the disease in general.
Well, I think I just want to say, you know, I'm lucky in a couple of counts. One, I'm in remission. I've lived through it, but it's 10 years on. So I'm in a position where I can be a bit neutral about it. I'm not emotionally affected by it anymore, really. Where there are a lot of people who are living through it, or even through the medication that they're on, they are, you know, there's highs and lows of that. I'm not on any meds, with the exception of testosterone injection.
Yeah.
I'm not on any meds to treat the tumor. And having worked in education as well, I feel like I'm in a good position where I can do this. And I had a lot of people help me out when I was undergoing my discovery. And I just want to try and give a bit back and coordinate it and, you know, I don't know, just do what I can, really.
So from your point of view, what do you think the unmet needs are of this community? I mean, one of the fascinating things to me was about the Canadian meeting was meeting so many people with acromegaly, which I had not really, even though I'm involved, I've been involved in this for 3 years. But the similarity of the stories are so poignant, no? And at the same time, like you're saying very well, each acromegaly patient has a unique story. And like my partner in this, Dr. Blevins, says, you know, there can be 150 people with acromegaly, and then there could be 150 of those same people, 150 different disease states. So every person is so unique with this condition. So what do you see as the unmet needs for this community? That things that are maybe not happening fast enough, you see a need, it's not. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, like I said, I mean, I'm very keen to see the social net groups try and forge a bigger alliance.
Mm-hmm.
I do appreciate that there are regional. So, if you're talking about medication, for example, the way that medication is distributed in the States is completely different to the UK, is completely different to other areas of Europe, and I understand that there are, you know, regional nuances.
Yes.
But I
there is differences in cost as well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there needs to be a space to talk about those things. But I would really, really love to see a wider community. And I also think, like I said earlier, the ability to tell your story in a way that will help others who are maybe undergoing diagnosis or treatment, or our specialists as well. Mm-hmm. To me, the biggest unmet need, and this is not necessarily within the community, but we all know that it's early diagnosis. I know that at the Canadian acromegaly conference, there was the discussion about gene sort of sampling and, you know, trying to detect it through sort of global gene testing. And
yeah.
Well, I can't see that happening in my lifetime.
No,
it might do, but that is such a huge task, and it's such a huge ethical query as well. Yeah. So again, you know, this is the role of advocacy groups, support groups like the Pituitary Foundation, who really need the ability to get the word out there.
Yes.
And for us to just, this is what I tried to do on November the 1st, yeah, is create that poster campaign which says, do you recognize any of these symptoms? And it might only be one or two. It might be that you notice it in someone else. And it's very hard to go up to someone and say, do you know what? You don't look right, or, you know, your jaw's really sticking out, or you have a big forehead, or your fingers are huge.
Yeah.
Now, it might be that's just how they are, but it also might be that they have a brain tumor.
Yeah.
And there should be no shame in sort of talking to someone and saying, look, I'm just going to sort of drop this on you, but have you considered this, or why don't you get it checked out? And we know that that's happened, and we know it's had incredible results.
Yeah, yeah. Awareness is a very practical, and if you really think about it, a very simplistic way of looking at it, because all you need is for the patient to be somewhat aware that this could be a possibility, and for the physician to put it on the list of possibilities and maybe run, like you mentioned, an IGF-1 or a glucose tolerance growth hormone test.
Yeah.
So those are simple solutions that I think in many, many cases, if people think about it, they would discover it much, much earlier. And that would have a tremendous impact on the person's quality of life, obviously.
Yeah, because we all know the big challenge is the fact that it's not normally detected until about 8 years after the tumor starts to grow. And it's such a subtle development.
Precisely.
That you don't know. And then by the time you realize something's wrong, it's not that it's too late, but it's, you know, it's fully developed.
Yeah.
It's very difficult, though. It really is a challenge. And I still don't know what the answer is. But I think the other thing I wanted to add is that I was at the Pituitary Foundation conference in Birmingham, mm-hmm, a month ago. Had specialists from the Queen Elizabeth Hospital there, and they have fantastic systems for example, patients that they are seeing to be able to talk to each other through the internet.
Oh, yeah.
So they have like a closed area where A, they can go and find resources, and B, they can perhaps communicate with other people who may be undergoing the same thing. Not everybody wants to use Facebook, for example. Not everybody may want to be public in their discussion.
Yes.
So those kinds of support resources, I think, are, you know, potentially extremely important, invaluable. Yeah.
We often talk about here at the Pituitary World about the silent majority, and yes, how the you know, the extremes are the ones that talk a lot. You know, yes, they're very happy and they're very unhappy. And it's a very positive thing, but we have to be able to get to that silent majority. Yeah.
Well, we also know, and I've seen it on social media, that there can be some voices who are very negative.
That happens, yes, too.
And you're undergoing a bad experience, and we appreciate that.
Yeah.
But there are people that may read it and then think, oh, my God, this is going to happen to me, or they get incredibly scared. Because, as we know, sometimes the loudest voices come through, and it's not always a balanced view. And it takes sometimes people like myself to say, hey, don't worry. We're all here. You're going to be fine.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people, this may be their first ever trip to hospital.
Yes.
You know, it can be very scary. Yeah. So
the book that you wrote is fantastic, and I know people are going to want to get a hold of it. And we did a thing on our Pituitary World News on it last year, and we have a link there. But why don't you tell people how they can get a hold of you, if you'd like, and where they could get the book? And we will definitely put a link to it on the story, on the podcast. So,
okay, thank you. Well, you can buy the paperback version in all the usual places like Amazon and Kobo. There's also the ebook version, which has all the pictures that you get on the website included as well. So Kindle and iBook.
Okay.
And there's also an audiobook version. So if people are fans of Audible, then you've got a monthly subscription, you can get the audiobook too. And that seems to be going down really well at the minute. So the audiobook's narrated by me, and it's very funny. So
it is. It's hilarious. It really is.
Well, it's very open and honest. Yeah. And I think sometimes with our conditions, we need to be. And I think for men as well, in particular, you know, when we're talking about testosterone and sex lives, and sometimes it's hard to be honest about it. So I just wanted to sort of try and, you know, open up and actually make people aware that may not be aware that we have to go through these things. So I'm really proud of it, and it's doing really well. So
excellent. So the book is called Me, Myself, and I,
a memoir.
Thank you so much for taking the time, and I hope you continue to do the great work that you're doing, and that we'll run into each other again in one of these conferences and work together on this great need that exists. So
yeah, and thank you to you and, you know, and your colleagues for running websites like yours, because it's crucial to raise the awareness, and you can sometimes see things from an angle that others might not, and, you know, especially when you've lived through it too. So, you know, keep up the good work.
Thank you, Dan. It's been a pleasure talking to you. The book is Me, Myself, and I, and you can find a link to Dan Jeffrey's website on the Pituitary World News site. You have been listening to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. This is Jorge Facinetti. Thank you for listening.